Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's okay. We understand. Really, we do. It's been a rough couple of months for you, and you haven't really been giving it your all at the office. Just so you understand, not everybody's that forgiving. We learned today worker productivity's been sliding. Not a good thing for inflation, the economy, or anything else, really. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's the 6th of June today. The headline economic report was that productivity number. Companies got less out of their employees in the first quarter than the government had originally guessed. Worker productivity grew at the relatively low rate of just 1%. That's about half of the earlier estimate. If it sounds like a distinction without too much of a difference, well, it sort of does. We called Greg McBride at Bankrate.com to clear things up.
With that productivity slowing, that's a negative signal as far as inflation is concerned. That drives up employment costs, which ultimately has inflationary consequences.
Yes, inflation again. It was the name of the game in the markets today, too. Wall Street gave it up early. McBride says investors are finally realizing they've been laboring under something of a misapprehension.
The question really isn't whether the Fed is paying attention, it's whether investors are paying attention to the Fed. The Federal Reserve and Ben Bernanke in particular have been very consistent in recent months talking about inflation, that is the primary concern of the Federal Reserve. Meanwhile, investors have been holding out hope, holding out this dream that the Fed was going to cut rates.
It's not only the U.S. Federal Reserve that won't be cutting rates. Today, the European Central Bank bumped its key rate up a quarter of a percentage point. If you're thinking right about now, yeah, that doesn't make much of a difference to you. Here's Greg McBride one last time.
One of the things about the United States economy is that we are very dependent on overseas investors bringing their money to our shores. That's how we finance our current account and budget deficits. If all of a sudden there are more attractive yields in other countries, Uncle Sam's going to have to pay higher returns in order to keep those investors sending their dollars to the United States.
Greg McBride at Bankrate.com. It is worth a mention here that it wasn't just Wall Street that tumbled on interest rate fears. European markets fell across the board as well, about a percent, percent and a half. There's lots going on in Washington this week, immigration in the Senate, and we'll get to that in a bit. The House is tackling spending bills for the 2008 fiscal year that starts October the 1st. Today, the House Appropriations Committee approved two more of the total of 12 bills that make up the government's spending plan. Democrats are pressing ahead with some pretty hefty spending increases, challenging President Bush to make good on his threat to veto the ones that bust his budget. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports now on the likelihood of an ugly confrontation over the budget come September.
The two spending bills approved today exceed the president's request by more than $5 billion. The committee's largesse for veterans' health care even surpassed the wish list put out every year by veteran service organizations. Last night, the committee okayed $32 billion for the Department of Homeland Security that overshot the White House proposal by more than $2 billion.
I think we're giving them too much money. They don't need it.
Kentucky Representative Harold Rogers is the ranking Republican on the House Homeland Security Appropriations Subcommittee. He says this bill is a 16% increase, much of it for grants for state and local first responder agencies, such as police and fire departments.
That account already has some $5 billion laying there waiting to be spent. And I just don't think it's wise in fiscally prudent times to pour more money into a hopper when very little is coming out the other end.
Still, Representative Rogers voted for the Homeland Security bill, as well as for both of today's generous spending proposals. Heritage Foundation budget scholar Brian Riedel says the Republican budget record so far this decade leaves them little standing to block the Democrats' spending plans.
The Republican Congress is responsible for the 40% increase in domestic discretionary spending since 2001, and many of them are not resisting the Democrats' spending ways. Runaway spending is a bipartisan problem.
House Republicans are being asked to sign a pledge that they will sustain any presidential budget vetoes. The leadership says they are close to having the 145 pledges they need to avoid any congressional overrides this fall. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Remember not too long ago, Walmart tried to get into the banking business? Ferocious opposition from the banking lobby played a role in stopping that attempt, but it's not stopping Walmart from offering an ever larger menu of bank-like services. A report in the Financial Times today said the next step will be something called the Walmart Money Card. Essentially, it's a prepaid Visa aimed at the 80 million U.S. residents who don't have bank accounts. It's not altruism, to be sure, but Marketplace's Steve Tripoli tells us the nation's largest retailer may have something to teach competitors about the upside of serving the poor.
Walmart won't confirm the card's coming, but the company says it's no secret that it's rolling out more financial services. Folks with no bank accounts already get check cashing and money transfers at Walmart. The money card reportedly will help them get financial services for less. Analyst George Whalen of Retail Management Consultants says that's where the company's cut comes in.
It tends to bind the customer to Walmart even more. If they're carrying around this Walmart cash card, essentially, they're more likely to go shop in Walmart than in JCPenney or some other store.
So why don't JCPenney and others follow Walmart's lead? Analyst Bernard Sosnick at Oppenheimer says it's easier to provide financial services to less profitable, poorer customers when you have Walmart's scale.
Walmart has been incredibly effective with logistics and technology. You have to handle a lot of units. You have to be very efficient. It's tough.
It's tough, but not impossible. Big banks and retailers have been reluctant to fully embrace poor communities, but George Whalen says many small retail chains have done good business there. We're talking 80 million people outside the financial mainstream. They spend money. Whalen says Walmart's one of the first big players to fully grasp the value of that market.
If you look at this tremendous population in the lower income brackets here in the U.S., I think this is a customer that they certainly want to reach out to more and continue to expand that business, and this is another opportunity.
Walmart's planning to expand space in its stores for financial services. It's giving customers something its competitors either won't provide or won't provide cheaply. That's retailing 101, no? I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Here's an unusual argument in favor of gay marriage that'll be music to the ears of state treasurers everywhere. New York City's controller has released a report that says the Big Apple would net $142 million during the first 3 years of legalized gay marriage. New York State overall would get $184 million, mainly from the uptick in visitors attending the nuptials. Ashley Milne-Tite looked into whether cash might carry the political day.
The report says same-sex couples planning to marry and spend the night in New York State would spend about $60 million in the 3 years after gay marriage became legal. Friends and family would spend millions too. David Birdsell is Dean of Public Affairs at New York City's Baruch College. He says the report's numbers are pretty conservative.
They assume that gay and lesbian marriages will spend less per marriage than the average heterosexual couple marriage.
On the flip side, the report also states that some businesses would have to pay more in healthcare costs if gay marriage was legalized. Matt Foreman of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force says gay marriage would bring more tourist dollars to New York. But he says gay marriage is about more than just money.
The much larger picture is not about money and not about tax revenue and not about income streams to hotels. It's really about protecting families.
That is, giving gay couples the same legal rights and responsibilities as heterosexual ones. But could the money angle sway lawmakers? Baruch's David Birdsell says gay marriage would only bring in a fraction of the tourist dollars the state and city already receive.
So I think that this is unlikely to be the hinge that will change many people's opinion, but it certainly buttresses the notion that this is consistent with sound public management.
Birdsell says that the better you treat people, the more money they'll spend, and the more often they'll return. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Once again, investors found themselves at the mercy of the bond market. Fears of rising interest rates drained Wall Street's enthusiasm. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The immigration reform bill has lived to fight again another day, although it might not be much more than one. Today, the Senate voted down an amendment that could have been a deal killer. The proposal would have made it impossible for criminals to become citizens. It would have included anybody who'd broken the law in order to stay here illegally. So the debate is still open on the floor, which leaves employers in labor-intensive industries like agriculture watching from the sidelines. And Marketplace's Megan Larson reports immigration reform could affect every step of the food chain.
It's an unlikely place for a farm, but right off the 405 freeway in Costa Mesa, California, Richard Manicero grows about a half dozen fruit and vegetable crops. Every two or three days, workers comb through the strawberry field, picking and pruning the plants of ripe red fruit. 12 men and women are on the job this morning, just enough to handle this four-acre patch. But in a few months, when his beans and sweet corn come in, Manicero will need at least 60 people to help harvest the vegetables. He says he may have trouble filling those spots.
We try to keep as many workers as we can and acquire as many as we can, but what happens is we'll be picking and coming along fine, and as production increases, we don't have enough employees to harvest and keep up on our schedule, our harvesting schedule. And as a result, we have to lay out certain blocks of the field and basically abandon them.
Those wasted crops mean lost revenue, as much as $80,000 a year. Manicero says the fix lies in comprehensive immigration reform. Like so many farmers, Manicero wants a stable legal workforce to draw on in the U.S. He supports legislation to create a guest worker program and to legalize the 12 million illegal immigrants currently living here. But Rick Altman of the group Californians for Population Stabilization argues that there's a downside.
At a certain point, you've got to say, look, you know, there is a limit to what the country can take. And we don't feel it is a fair trade to overpopulate the country to the point of a half billion people just so business can get their, you know, their next fix of cheap labor. It's just not fair.
Manicero, who pays minimum wage to his workers, says he'd be happy to hire Americans, but few of them will do this kind of work.
We've tried in years past where the EDD, Employment Development Department, has sent people out that were on unemployment to come out and try to work with us, and we've had them, and I think some people lasted a day. We've had other people only last a half day. Some people walked out after an hour.
Thomas Nassif, president and CEO of Western Growers, an agriculture industry trade group, says the need isn't only in the fields. Foreign workers, he says, are integral to every link on the food chain.
It takes in dairy and poultry. It takes in all these meat packing plants, beef and pork, and all the workers in those plants. It takes the people who are in packing sheds.
And from packing sheds to the distributors and all the way to the markets and the restaurants.
Hello, welcome to Ecogini.
Ecogini is one of 16 restaurants owned and operated by the King Seafood Company in Southern California. Chairman and co-founder Jeff King sides with Manicero on the issue of immigration reform. He says his business and the restaurant industry as a whole will suffer without it.
There are about 12 million restaurant workers in the country, and in 7 years we're going to be short 1,900,000. Short.
Just take a tour of Ecogini's kitchen, and everyone from the head chef to the dishwasher is from Central or South America. Sous chef Edgar Hernandez came to the U.S. as a teenager and attained citizenship just last year. He hopes others have the same opportunities as he did.
Unfortunately, some of them, you know, they don't have legal papers to work, but they provide the labor, and they're hard workers. They really are.
Manicero says that's the point. He's hoping that new immigration laws will allow his workers to keep making their contribution here in the U.S. I'm Megan Larson for Marketplace.
Assuming the Senate keeps to its schedule, Majority Leader Harry Reid's promising a key vote on the immigration bill tomorrow, and reform will keep limping along, or it will be dead for now. Either way, commentator David Frum says legalizing millions of would-be immigrants has some poor side effects, literally.
An estimated 40 million immigrants have arrived in the United States since 1970, one-third of them illegally. Most of them are looking to better their lives through work. But when the United States imports immigrants, it imports not just willing hands. It imports something else, too. Poverty. Unlike pre-1970 immigrants, post-1970 immigrants have tended to stay poor for decades after their arrival in the United States. More than one-third of all the people living in immigrant households in the United States are poor. And more than one-fifth of all the poor people in the United States are immigrants. It's no mystery why this should be so. Three-quarters of the post-1970 immigrants come from Mexico and Central America. These post-1970 immigrants are far less educated and far less skilled than the pre-1970 immigrants were. One-third of all the post-1970 immigrants have not even completed high school. And illegals are the least educated and least skilled of all. The warning signs strongly suggest that the children and grandchildren of the post-1970 immigrants will lag behind for generations. Barely half of all Hispanic youngsters graduate from high school on time. Half of all Hispanic babies are born to unmarried mothers. The biggest American domestic policy failure of the past two decades has been the crumbling of the social and economic status of the poorer half of the population. Their wages are declining, their families are disintegrating, their health care is deteriorating, and the gap between them and the wealthier half of the population is steadily widening. Conservatives and liberals differ about how best to address these problems. The left emphasizes unions and social programs. The right thinks the answer will be found by strengthening marriage and improving education. But if there's one thing that both sides should agree on, it is this. If you have a problem you don't know how to solve, stop making it worse by admitting so many unskilled migrants.
David Frum is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. Confidence is the key to sealing any deal, right?
One of the biggest concerns you have is when someone says there is no competition or we're not worried about the competition.
Well, maybe not. Coming up, inventors court investors in 5 minutes or less. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lopped off 129 points today, just under 1% to close at 13,465. The Nasdaq fell 24 points, 0.9%, to end at 2587. The S&P 500 down 13 points, 0.8%, finished at 1517. Whole Foods broke off 3% today. Yesterday, federal authorities said they'd file a lawsuit against the organic grocer on antitrust grounds. Its takeover object, Wild Oats, wasn't sowing any. Stock in that company fell 1.2%. Investors panned Panera Bread. The bakery chain sliced off more than 13% today after cutting its quarterly earnings and sales forecast. Bond prices rose today. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped just a tad to 4.97%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. A couple big reports out. Chain stores announce sales figures for May, and the Federal Reserve Board reports on consumer credit. A House committee holds a hearing on improving credit card consumer protection. And if you're in the mood for some super activities, head for Metropolis, Illinois. There you will find all things non-kryptonite during the Superman celebration starting tomorrow. Eat your Wheaties. There's a lot to do. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. When President Bush began his push for immigration reform more than a year ago, he visited a Dunkin' Donuts in Northern Virginia to do a photo op with the press. How come? Well, the company had just decided to participate in a federal pilot program designed to help businesses weed out illegal immigrants. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports now the donut giant is taking it one step farther.
This April, the owner of a Dunkin' Donuts franchise in Connecticut was sent to jail and fined $1 million for smuggling illegal workers into the country. Now, the corporation's cracking down. In the last few months, Dunkin' Brands accused the owners of Dunkin' Donuts stores in Florida, Atlanta, Massachusetts, and New Jersey of failing to obey immigration laws. Robert Zarco is an attorney who represents some of those small business owners.
It appears to me that Dunkin' is acting as a private enforcer of governmental policies.
The company is taking all of these small businesses to court, attempting to sever its relationship with them.
I don't think that that's very common. At least it's not something that I've seen in my practice.
Bethany Appleby is an attorney at Wiggins & Dana. She specializes in franchise law. She says usually when a company like Dunkin' Donuts tries to close down a franchise, it's because the place is a mess or isn't paying royalties. But there are a number of signs Dunkin' Brands has put a lot of pressure on its franchisees recently to make sure their employees are in this country legally. Tim Bells, executive director of the Chicago Workers Collaborative.
A number of employees have come into our organization complaining that they were fired from Dunkin' Donuts on the basis of their Social Security numbers.
Some immigrant groups in Chicago have called for a boycott of the chain. Dunkin' Brands officials declined to comment on tape, but said their company was just trying to do the right thing. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
One of the arguments you hear in the immigration debate is this. If we can move goods all over the planet in this era of globalization, why not move people, too? Send them where the jobs are. As it stands now, we move the jobs. U.S. software firms outsourcing to India, for example. In fact, that's being done so much, India itself now faces a shortage of qualified engineers. So, what do companies there do? Why, they outsource to even lower-cost countries. Just last week, India's largest computer services provider, Tata Consultancy, opened a new office in Mexico. From the Americas desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gratch has more.
Tata's software development center in Guadalajara will eventually employ 5,000 people, all doing tasks currently handled in India. Ankur Prakash directs Tata's Mexico operation. He says the U.S. represents half of Tata's business. Servicing those customers forced Indian employees to work through the night.
So Mexico being in the same time zone as the United States, we can definitely support all of these applications from Mexico during the daytime. So this will completely take away the problem that we had of the night shift.
Mexico is also much closer to the U.S., cutting travel time and expense. And it provides a hedge against India's overheated economy by spreading Tata's workforce around the world. Other Indian companies, such as consulting firms, software developers, call centers, are also beginning to outsource. Jyoti Narsimhan is with the economic forecaster Global Insight.
With India growing so rapidly, we're seeing an inevitable rise in wages, and so we see many of these concerns hiring elsewhere, partly to diversify and partly to take advantage of low wages elsewhere.
They're doing what we do, going where the prices are lower.
Jagdish Bhagwati is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
A lot of people are finding India actually getting to be a tight market, and many of the salaries are international salaries. So it's not that cheap to go there anymore.
One wrinkle to the Tata outsourcing. While they're better located, Mexican engineers aren't actually cheaper. Their salaries are 30% higher than those in India. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
For anybody who's ever thought they could come up with the next Yahoo or Google, that was the easy part. All you need to do now is come up with a couple of million dollars. Enter the Hatchery. It's a monthly money event in New York City that matches dot-com dreamers with venture capitalists. There's one tonight featuring a panel of female VCs and other experts. The catch is would-be entrepreneurs only have 5 minutes to seal the deal. Sally Herships stopped by the most recent Hatchery event to talk about the art of the pitch.
I'm here at Columbia University's Business School, where Gigapixel, a web development company, is matchmaking people with good business ideas and no money with venture capitalists who can write out a million-dollar check on the spot. But presenters only have 5 minutes to pitch. Ever since the internet bubble burst in 2000, venture capital speed dating has gotten tough.
I don't like hearing you say that, you know, when you've just barely...
What I'm not really seeing here is something particularly clever or unique.
But how do you get someone to pull out their checkbook?
Tell me about the market. What is your unique solution? And why should I believe that you're uniquely capable of doing this?
Venture capitalist Josh Grotstein sees as many as 1,000 plans a year, but only ends up funding 5 or 6.
VCs have a one-track mind. What they want to hear isn't so much about the product. It's about how to get around the obstacles. Marketing. Competition.
One of the biggest concerns you have is when someone says there is no competition or we're not worried about the competition, because that tends to signal that they're not that savvy in terms of starting a business.
Adrian Lai gives big money to companies in later stages of development. She says an experienced management team is key.
You know, you much rather invest in an A-plus management team with a B business than something the other way around, you know, sort of an A business with a B-plus kind of management team.
Even if you have the dream team and the dream five-minute pitch, what are your chances of getting a check?
No chance.
Jason Olam is an early internet entrepreneur who's been on both sides of the pitch.
Probably takes 60 to 90 days before a company gets bankrolled. But that five-minute pitch can be how the introduction is made in the first place.
And that introduction is critical because after the bubble burst in the 90s, venture capital investment went from $100 billion a year to a fraction of that. It's slowly coming back. The National Association of Venture Capitalists says last year VCs gave $26 billion to young companies. That's almost half as much as Bill Gates is worth.
It's definitely getting easier now.
But to the person pitching, that's not how it feels. Seth Gilmore.
I definitely don't think that timer was 5 minutes, though. I think it was much shorter than that because I timed myself in the bathroom and it was always like 4 minutes and 30 seconds.
Time's up. I'm Sally Herships from Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, today we say goodbye to somebody who taught Americans the esoteric economic discipline of game theory. Yes, I'm talking about Bob Barker, host of CBS's game show The Price is Right. Barker taped his last episode of the show here in Los Angeles today. You're going to have to wait until June 15th to see it. But in his 35 years on the air, Barker challenged contestants to guess the price of everyday household items. Like a brand new washer-dryer or an all-expenses-paid vacation to Hawaii. But behind the cheesy music and product placements and cheesy announcers, too, and impressions of them, the show is actually a dream for behavioral economists. Every episode was a case study in how hard it is to actually make complex calculations in just moments. The 83-year-old Barker officially starts his retirement tomorrow. We officially start ours right now. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 129 points, just under 1%. The NASDAQ dropped 24 points, about 0.9%. The S&P 500 fell 13 points. That is 0.8%. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba. Next time on the program, all those for sale signs are raising some eyebrows.
And actually seeing people on the street move from one residence to another residence on the same street, I mean, just something didn't make sense.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.